The following program is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network. Geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, Nerdapalooza, the world's largest nerd music festival, and with the generous support of listeners like you. For more Nerdy Show podcasts, community forums, and learn how you can support this and other fine Nerdy Show programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
Are here tonight with Greg Rucker, winner of 4 Eisner Awards, 1 Harvey Award, and 1 GLAAD Award. I am also here not only with Greg Rucker, with Brian.
Hello.
And I'm also here with Jared.
I'm not actually here in the interview.
You're going to say that the whole time, aren't you?
Yes, he is. And I met Greg Rucker over at Heroes Con, and I'm very excited to have him here on the show. I want to ask a little bit about your nerdy personal life, if that's kind of cool. Like, I just wanted to know, like, do you do any kind of gaming, any kind of, like, computer gaming or, like, Xbox or PlayStation?
You know, I haven't actually had much time in the last sort of month, 6 weeks. Prior to that, you know, that was pretty much the primary form of recreation at night. Getting on the 360, and I have a group of friends that we do a Mass Effect multiplayer with, and my son is a huge soccer fan, and he and I play FIFA, the FIFA franchise games.
Nice.
But the last six to 8 weeks, I've been sort of underwater with regards to work, so I honestly haven't been on very much. And then, you know, you ask about outside that. I'm a huge, you know, role-playing gamer. I'm a big tabletop gamer. But, you know, just as much as I haven't been able to get on online to play with the Xbox, there's been no time to do any gaming. I've been running a Call of Cthulhu campaign for my wife, Jennifer Van Meter, who's a writer in comics as well, and Matt Fraction and Kelly Sudokonik and artist Matthew Clark all play in it. And we, man, I think the last time we played was June. We lost the whole summer, so we're trying to get back on schedule for that.
Oh, that's awesome. So you guys just, like, go meet up, or you do this all, like, via Skype? And
well, they're all in Portland, so
we'll
try to, you know, have them over, and we have dinner and tell the kids not to bother us in 3 or 4 hours. But it honestly has been a fairly bumpy process. You know, Kelly Sue's work schedule is such that she, like, gets up at 3-4 in the morning, you know, to write. So when you try to get together to game, you know, at 8 at night, and one of your players is falling asleep at the table, there's only so much progress you tend to make.
Right.
We got to figure out a better time, a better window for all of us to be able to play.
Oh, that's awesome, though. That's fantastic. Okay, now as far as comic, like,
yeah.
Do you read...
those things.
Yeah, those things. You know, something that I think you're familiar with.
Yeah.
Like, do you read any comics? Like, are you keeping up with any, like, the Marvel, DC, or any independents?
You know, I don't chase a lot of the big two stuff anymore. I've been reading. I'm more, and it's not that I don't love the characters. I guess it's just that I think I've reached a point where I'm more interested in following creators as they sort of pursue things outside of, you know, the big two characters. I've been enjoying Jeff Lemire's Trillium immensely. You know, when Bendis brings out an issue of Scarlet, you know, I've been reading Hawkeye, obviously, just because I think the book is dangerous in what it's making the rest of us look like in comics. I think what Matt and what David are doing there is phenomenal. You know, I've been reading Captain Marvel Obviously, I picked up pretty deadly.
What did you think? I didn't get a chance to read it. We sold out. What did you think? Did you enjoy it?
I did. I enjoyed it very much so. I thought it was a... I thought it did everything I wanted out of a first issue. It made me want to read the second.
Right.
But, you know, I admit to a bias. You know, I tend to like the things my friends do. You know, I'm very much looking forward to Anthony Johnston's Umbral, for instance. You know, and I'd be, so it's weird because books come into the house and they stack up and then I go into them. I haven't been reading a whole lot of stuff outside of, you know, very specific, like, this came out, I want to read it right now. Otherwise, you know, the pile is just getting bigger because, like I said, I've been really, really busy.
Right.
And I feel guilty, you know. No, in all sincerity, I do. I feel guilty because there are so many people out there that are like, I'm so far behind on what Wade's doing in Daredevil. It's not funny, you know.
Right. Well, you sound like every other comic nerd. I'm so far behind on my books.
There you go. I guess, well, there are my bona fides. I'm a comics nerd.
That is now, do you have a favorite writer, of course, outside yourself and your wife?
I have several favorite writers outside of myself and my bride, and I will not go and make a laundry list of them, for I am old and wise enough to know better than offending people who will be hearing this. There, you know, I mean, there's so many. We really are in a golden age right now, I think. We've got so much talent sort of swinging for the fences. You know, I discovered Matt Kent's Mind Management a couple months ago, and I had a moment where I was like, how did I miss this book?
Right.
You know, how did I not know about this? So, and that's not rare, you know. That's not rare. There are more and more books coming out where I'm really the mean quality of what's coming out right now, I think, is as high as I've ever seen it. So,
yeah, it's funny. At our shop, a comic shop, we felt like this past 2 years has really been the rise of the independents, as we've called it. It's, you know, of course, DC, Marvel, they're great, and we love them and everything, but it's to see all these, like, creative-owned properties come up and all these new characters being developed is just fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just jumping all over it, and Aaron, who's my boss, is all about it. He always, if he loves something, he hypes it, and we always sell out of it.
Yeah. That is wonderful to hear. Keep it up. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're big supporters. Like, we were big supporters of your Lazarus, which Brian and I both read, and we enjoyed very much.
Fantastic to hear.
Yeah, so, we're at Trillium, Mind Management, all that stuff. And then to sell...
I've been enjoying, I think I mentioned The Wake, you know?
Oh, that's so good.
Really, really enjoying this stuff. So there is a piece of me that wants to see, you know... I mean, it used to be that everybody would go and do their independent work and they'd end up, you know, at DC or Marvel.
Right.
There's a piece of me that's, I think, because of the way that the big two have had to change in the last couple of years, you're seeing more and more people sort of hone their skills at the big two and then go off to Images and Onis and the like and be able to indulge there, which to me is really exciting. You know, there is a joy in doing work for hire. You know, there's a real pleasure to be found in writing, you know, these characters that have such wonderful legacies and such fantastic history. But there's, you know, there's only so much you can do there. And to be given an opportunity in an environment where, you know what, you get to go to town now. You get to do what you want to do the way you want to do it. That's rare, and, you know, I'm in favor of it. I want more.
Well, now that you really like working in the independent world, like, do you have, as an independent writer, do you have free reign to really do whatever you want, or are there restrictions? Like, the way the big companies always give you, the big two give the restrictions on their characters, do you have free reign to do whatever?
We have not encountered anything in Lazarus that has ever made me think that Image is going to say, no, you can't do that.
Right.
And I know for a fact I've never had that problem at Oni, ever.
Right.
You know, Honey Press has never once said, we would rather that you did not do that. That's pushing it a little too far or whatnot. It's never happened. You know, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's great to have that kind of freedom of speech kind of thing, to do whatever you want, whatever you dream of.
You have to follow the story where the story needs to go.
Right. And for my own curiosity, I always wanted to know, as like when you were doing Lazarus, Comic with Lazarus, did you choose your artist or did they choose one for you? Like, how does that work?
Oh, well, in that instance, that was very much me going to Michael Lark and saying, I have an idea, what do you think? And Michael going, I like that idea and would like to be a part of it. You know, in the past, I've had instances of both with Oni, you know, going to them and saying, here's the thing that I want to do this, you know, and I've been talking to this artist and that's the package. And there have been other times when I've been like, I have an idea. I have no idea who can draw it. And, okay. You know, an editor will suggest, you know, this artist or that artist for whatever purpose.
Do you make, as the writer, do you make the final decision of which artist you want to work with you, or do you let them choose?
In work for hire, no.
Okay.
It would be nice to say that, I had that ability, but, you know, when you're working at a Marvel or at a DC, if you're lucky, you get an editor who's going to say, you know, here are three or four people that we're looking at. Is there one that you like? With creator-owned material, I've never collaborated with anybody I absolutely didn't want to be collaborating with.
Okay. All right. Awesome. Oh, that's fantastic. Okay. Now, I need to know something, because when you did Wonder Woman issue 219, I remember walking into my comic shop back in that day, and that was all the buzz. I was like, really? Everybody's talking about Wonder Woman? So, of course, I bought it. And I was blown away. Now, I've always...
You hadn't read anything prior to that?
I read all her build-up, but I didn't understand why everybody was talking about it, this one issue. You know? So I was wondering, like, how did you get away with having her killed? Especially then.
It wasn't a get away with. It was part of what was going on at that time at DC. You know, that was some of the best work I think that DC had done in that decade was the ramp up into Infinite Crisis.
Right.
And that was always an element of it. You know, one of the theses of that event was that the DCU does not work when Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman are not all on the same page.
Right.
You know, when there's a fracture between them, then the DC universe suffers, and it suffers grievously. So, you know, the Max Lord arc was an arc that, you know, we had built to over a couple of years. You know, that was not something that we pulled out of the hat and did without really considering how we were going to get there and also where we wanted to go after. Unfortunately, a lot of where we wanted to go after got ejected because, I left. I was fired off the book fairly shortly thereafter. So we never got to deal with the after effects. And then, right. And then the DC universe went into sort of their soft reboot at that point.
Right.
And now you have the new 52. So you're never going to be able to go back and revise that. But you know, that it was not created in a vacuum. That was worked up with, you know, all of us were working together on our storylines and working very, very closely to sort of shape the direction of the DCU at that time.
Wow. So is everybody's decision and the company and everybody and themselves were on board with you with doing this? And so it was pretty easy to have her do it?
No, because that makes it seem like, you know, I sat down one day and I said, she needs to kill someone. and that's not what happened. What happened was we had been having conversations about characters, and I had maintained that, you know, one of the fundamental differences between Diana and Clark and Bruce is that Diana will kill.
Right.
She is a warrior from a warrior culture, and she knows that monsters are real and does not come from a paradigm that says, and therefore everything must be rehabilitated. Sometimes, you know, the monster has to be taken out, and sometimes the monster looks just like you and me. You know, Max put her into a position where, to Diana, that was the only viable alternative. Were there other choices? One could argue that, yes, there were. But for the purpose of the story, for where Diana was standing, the argument is that that was the only choice she could make. Yeah, so we went around and around and around on it before we committed to anything.
Wow. Wow, and I got to say
that. Believe it or not, and I know sometimes it does not appear to be the case, and often it isn't the case, but every now and then the stuff that happens actually is done because people really, really sat down and put a lot of thought into it. Sometimes they don't. And you see that, I think, frankly, we see that more and more in certain places where where the effect is the thing that is being sought, not the story. I would say that one of the differences between, you know, Diana killing Max Lord and a lot of the other sort of sensationalist stuff we've seen of late is that that's a story that was an entirely character-driven story. That was never meant to be a stunt. It got turned into a stunt after the fact because the result after the fact was that the repercussions of it were never dealt with.
Right.
They were swept under the rug. And honestly, if I had known that was how it was going to be handled, I would have fought against it. Because to me, it became the equivalent of doing a drive-by on the character. And I hate that. I hate it when writers do that.
Right.
And I resent still to this day. And it's, you know, that was a long time ago. To this day, I resent having been put in a position that I did a drive-by on her.
Wow. And it's funny, like the new Wonder Woman that I'm really loving Azzarello's run as well. And I feel that his Diana was very much kind of like what you were doing. Like you were making, to me, Diana the Amazon first. Not the ambassador so much. It's just I felt she was a very strong Amazon for the first time in a long time. And that's what I feel that Azzarello's doing with her. Like, have you read any of his stuff with her yet?
I've read some, yeah.
And what did you think? Did you?
I've been enjoying the majority of what I read.
Okay.
But I got to tell you, you know, Diana's character is very close to me. You know, I feel very strongly about her. I find it difficult in the same way that you're going to ask me about Kate later, I know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the answers are the same. You know, you invest a lot, as a writer, you invest a lot of time and energy and thought and passion. And when the relationship ends, it is very difficult to stay around.
Wow.
And it's as simple as that. You know, I find it very difficult to read Wonder Woman stories right now. In the same way that I found what J.H. and Hayden did on Batwoman, very difficult to read. It has nothing to do with the quality of the work. It has to do with my relationship with those characters.
So you take almost like the dissolving of the relationship as literally a relationship, like somebody you were with for this amount of time, X amount of time.
It is a relationship.
Right.
If you get it, well, no. There are people who can phone it in. I've never been able to do that. All right? And I take the job seriously. And I put a lot of effort into these characters and into understanding them and trying to give them the best I can give them. And when, for whatever reason, those relationships end, it's painful.
Wow.
And anyone who tells you it's not is either not committed to the work or full of shit. So
wow.
I really do feel that. I don't think that you can, you know, you cannot write these characters well if you are not passionate about them. And if you're passionate about them, then of course it's going to hurt when you leave.
That was beautiful.
I'm sure if it's beautiful, it's where I'm sitting, you know?
Yeah,
you know?
It's fantastic. Now, okay, I just recently found out that with her, with her character, you were slated to do Earth One for her.
Yeah.
And are you allowed to say, like, what your, to let me know, like, what your take was going to be on it? Like, what was the difference with her? Or do you not want to talk about it?
Well, I mean, we only got so far in it. J.H. and I had talked about it, and we had some ideas. You know, I've always loved the beauty of Diana's story for me is that she's always the stranger in the strange land. And one of the worst things that I think happened, certainly pre-New 52, was allowing her to come and go from Themyscira. I think that changes the character fundamentally. As soon as she can go home, she loses an element of her heroism. And she also loses her impetus to change and evolve. You know, we wanted to tell the story of a very young Diana and a story of a young woman who never belonged in her home and sacrifices everything she knows and all of her comfort to go to this world that she has really some very mistaken assumptions about and is in for a brutal reality check. You know, but she goes because she believes in what she's doing. You know, getting into anything more about it is runs the risk of being masturbatory.
Right.
You know, it would have been wonderful to do. I would have very much enjoyed doing it.
I would have loved to have read it, especially if you were to do it with JH, because I love the team with both of you when you work together on Batwoman. It's just such a beautiful team.
He's phenomenal. I mean, he is just such an outstanding collaborator. He really is. I mean, he's amazing. I mean, it's as simple as that. He's really amazing.
Like, I was, I love the storytelling, like when you were doing the Batwoman together, and then to see the art as well, and to see the pals and the popping of the reds. It was just so, like, I was entranced by it.
Yeah.
You know?
The art on that book is, you know, it was one of the tightest collaborations I've ever, ever had with any artist. There was nothing in those stories that didn't go on the page, you know, be it image or word, that he and I did not sweat over and did not talk to each other about. And I think that that result shows.
Right. And Brian, did you want
to... So, Greg, I have to admit, I've heard more about you over the years, and other than the Batwoman, up until about 12 months ago, I hadn't read a lot. But I know Josh Flanagan over at iFanboy would, you know, kind of sing your praises. And I was like, you know, I really got to check this out at some point. And, you know, of course, then we met you at Heroes, and it was like, oh, well, this is a good opportunity to dig in. So, Queen and Country, actually, really... I've made it through the first volume, and I actually have the second one in the way. I was like, oh, maybe I'll get through the second one before the interview. But I'll tell you, I'm actually a Navy contractor, and I don't do anything remotely similar to what, you know, obviously the Queen and Country books are about. But you speak in the Queen and Country books from a perspective that actually makes me go, you know, did you do research? I mean, obviously you did research, but did you have family or friends that were either military or in any kind of selective service roles, or is this just, I mean, you're just, that's how good a writer?
I especially for the QNC stuff, I did, you know, an inordinate amount of research. And, you know, some of the best compliments I've ever gotten are from people, you know, who are in the business and word got back to me that they read it and approved. You know, I have, Rachel Maddow once sent the QNC books to Senator Feinstein because, you know, she's on the Senate Foreign Intelligence Committee. So, you know, that's probably the best endorsement I could have ever gotten. You know, that kind of storytelling requires a verisimilitude that, you know, if I hadn't met it, the stories would have suffered. One of the things that I've always felt differentiates Queen and Country from almost all the other espionage out there is that Queen and Country was always about the political stakes and never let you forget that every story has, excuse me, two antagonists. You know, in the first instance, it's the enemy agency or terrorists or whatever that want to blow up the bridge or do whatever. But in the second instance, it's always the bureaucracy that Tara works for. Governments exist to self-perpetuate, you know? That's their primary goal. Everything else is secondary to it. And the idea that, you know, I had a friend who talked about, you know, the Black Hawk Down story. And one of the reasons that Black Hawk Down resonates so much is that it is the story of the human ethos required to get people to do what they do. Right, to rise to that level of sacrifice, colliding with the political expediency that says it would be so much easier if we could just leave everybody behind. You know what I mean? There is that element of story that says that story happens because the unit believes no man is left behind. Except the smart thing for the government to do is say, you know what, actually this time the man's left behind. Sorry. Really, really sorry about it, guys, but you gotta let it go.
Yeah.
That conflict exists within every, you know, every political institution. And I am, regardless of whether I'm writing about military, I'm writing about espionage, or I'm writing about cops or whatnot, I'm always fascinated by the human cost that we exact from the men and women we ask to, you know, rise to these levels of service.
Yeah, I mean, the real thing that spoke to me was that not only that cost on Tara and her relationships and her the therapist in that first volume she had to kind of deal with and work through, which some of my friends that I know have been licensed therapists that have gone to bases and talked. So they their stories lined up kind of eerily with yours. And then the territorialism among different departments, I mean, that's something I deal with day in day, mm-hmm. where we're all trying to help the warfighter, but we're also all trying to basically screw the other department, and, you know, and getting the approvals and yet not pissing off certain higher-ups. I mean, all of that just rang so true that I'm like, oh, he has to have either direct experience with this or he's just that good.
You know, and I've got a friend at the State Department, and he and I had a conversation once, and I guess we were talking. We met in D.C. We were in D.C. and we were walking along the mall, and we passed a stand, somebody who was, you know, flying one of the POW MIA flags and talking about sort of the conspiracy of you know those men that were left behind in Vietnam and that belief. And one of the things he said was, you know, people want to believe in these conspiracy theories, but the government's like every other workplace. You know, it's full of idiots and incompetence and petty venal, you know, rivalries and so on. And the idea that you could keep a grand conspiracy secret, let alone be able to keep it secret for 50 years, is laughable.
Yeah.
You know, and there is something, and that basically reduces to, well, it's a human institution. Of course it's not going to be able to keep a secret. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
It's so funny. It reminds me of Meltzer's Decoded series. I don't know if you've had a chance to see any of that.
No.
But Brad Meltzer makes, you know, a living being very, you know, prolific and getting all these great, you know, attention for his kind of conspiracy-minded book series. But yet you talk to him or you see any of his interviews and then the show Decoded, it was basically him debunking all of these well-known, you know, conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
And it all boiled down to, look, there's no proof, or, you know, we've basically shown that, you know, these people were lying or trying to, you know, stir something up, usually for their own advantage. But yeah, the other question I have about Queen and Country is, I noticed, at least from Volume 1, the art style was always very on the, like, more on the cartoony side than, like, you would maybe expect from an espionage or any kind of military involving story. Was that a choice to, like, what was the reasoning going into doing that kind of, or finding artists with that kind of style?
Well, that's not actually the style of Queen and Country, though. I mean, and you'll see it when you look at the later volumes. One of the things that I wanted at the start of QNC was I wanted an opportunity to work with a bunch of different artists. I've always felt that I've been fairly weak in that regard, that my understanding of how artists work and that side of the business was always I was far more ignorant of it than I wanted to be. And one of the things I wanted out of QNC was a way for me to educate myself, and to do that I wanted the opportunity to work with a wide array of artists. So I mean, in that first one, you're looking at, you know, Steve Ralston, who has a very open, simple line style that seems in really stark contrast to sort of the gritty realism, you know, of the espionage work. And then you see sort of the Nori Hurt Morningstar arc, and it's got a little more verisimilitude in its rendering. And then you hit Leo Fernandez, and it's just over-the-top caricature.
You know, yeah.
Croc's got a nose that you could use to open cans of soup. And Chase's chest is suddenly, you know, doubles as a life preserver. and it's actually quite shocking when you read it. You're like, whoa, wait a minute. That was, you know, both the pro and the con of doing it. You get into that second volume, you'll see something, you know, Jason Alexander's work on Operation, I say it's Black Wall. It's probably my favorite arc of QNC because it's the most sort of quintessential Tara Chase story. And his work is, you know, really sort of almost reminds you of early Sienkiewicz.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, and then here comes Carlos Speed McNeil, you know, and it's Carlos Speed McNeil. I mean, it's totally different.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was never really, you know, there was never really a house style for QNC. What I wanted, and one of the things that I made really clear to every artist as he or she came aboard was, no, you have to take what has been presented and then put your own stamp on it. And that is why Tara can look, sort of cartoony, sexy in the first arc and sort of a little dumpier, you know, in the second, and then like a Bond girl in the third, you know, and it would have been, I think it would have been foolish of me to have not allowed, you know, the artists who came aboard to really, you know, take their turn and run it the way they thought that they should.
Yeah. Typically, I know Bendis has talked about this, do you write for your artists? Do you kind of tailor your material so that it fits a certain artist's style? Or
I am doing it more and more these days. I have to admit that when I first started writing for comics, I didn't even understand the concept of doing it. And some of the first lessons that I was ever given by other writers in the industry did not actually dispose me well towards doing it. There were writers who talked about sort of insulating your scripts from artist interference. It was only really in the last, you know, several years that I've kind of realized that, hey, you know what? If it's going to be a collaboration, we have to collaborate. And these days, you know, I try very actively to write for the artists that I'm working with.
Hmm. Okay, now we're going to get on to Batwoman, the famous lesbian. I've always wondered how you were able to get here. Is like you're doing a major detective comics, one of the big, longest running comic books out there, and here you put this character, Kate, into this, and she's a lesbian. Like, how did it, was this your idea of making her a lesbian, or was that something that was thrown at you?
That was a choice that DC made.
Really?
I mean, that was actually one of the last things that Paul Levitz had put in motion before he left his position. You know, there had been a discussion about, as I understand it, bringing Batwoman back into continuity, and that from the get-go, they wanted her to be queer. And, you know, through a variety of, you know, events, both under DC's control and entirely out of DC's control, the character sort of ended up falling to me. And I think in part she fell to me because, you know, I had written Renee Montoya and the Half-Life story,
right,
and was seen to be somebody who could write queer characters with appropriate respect and humanity. But the goal, as it's always been explained to me, when DC decided we're bringing Batwoman back, the decision was made then and there, you know, and she will be gay. And it will not be an after-school special gay. She will be, you know, she's going to be a lesbian. That's part of the character. So, you know, when I first started writing her in 52, we didn't really have a good handle on who the character was, and there was a lot of stuff in flux.
Right.
When the time came to do what was supposed to be the Batwoman title and what ultimately became the issues that ran in Detective, that was a very deliberate, very considered process, you know, that Jim and myself and the editor on the book, Michael Seguin, we spent a lot of time really trying to hone and craft an origin that would sustain her, that would last, that would be resonant, and try to create a character that, you know, there would never be any doubt of her sexual orientation, but that her sexual orientation was an element of her character. It wasn't what defined her.
Right.
You know, because that's absurd. It's absurd to say, oh, he's the gay hero. You know, I was like, no, you know, he's the hero who does this, 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 and this. He's also gay. You know, our sexuality is an element of who we are. It's not all we are. And doing that with a character, you know, presenting a character in that fashion would be irresponsible at the least and incompetent at the most. You know, we wanted people to understand, and frankly, we knew it was an uphill battle too, because there had been the New York Times thing, there had been all this publicity about, oh, she's gay, you know, but like right. Actually, she's just a badass,
right?
You know, I just it mattered that she was queer, but it also needed to not matter at the same time. It's a very odd tightrope, you know, because we you never ever wanted to ignore or take for granted that it was a big deal. This is an out character wearing arguably the most recognizable icon that DC/Warner Brothers owns.
Right.
But at the same time, like I said, we've never wanted to make it an after school special. Oh, look, she's gay, but she's just like you and me. She's not. She's awesome. She's better than you and me. You know?
Right. And I love that. I love that.
Bad guys up. She's great, you know. So,
and the way you and the way you wrote it, and the way JH like illustrated it, it was just such a beautiful. Just watching her kick ass,
yeah.
Beat the crap out of people.
You know, and again, the best advice I can give anybody when working with JH is, you know, communicate openly and then get the hell out of his way.
Oh, so that's how that works with him?
No, I mean, that makes it sound like he's, you know, he's bossy or he's a prima donna or something. He's not. I mean, he is a fantastic collaborator. But, you know, you don't, I'm trying to think of a good analogy. You know, you don't go to Scotland to drink the gin. You know what I mean?
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You let people do the thing that they're good at. And I really felt that, especially in those first couple issues, you know, he was, comics are a language, and he was really, I think, cutting a whole new dialect, so.
Oh, he absolutely was. It was absolutely stunning. Now, I remember at HeroesCon, when we were talking, you mentioned to me that you didn't want to make her a lipstick lesbian. Like, what was your...
That had been the quote, right? Because the quote that had been attributed to DiDio in the New York Times was that something like, and the new Batwoman, Kate Kane, is a lipstick lesbian. Dan doesn't know what a lipstick lesbian is. I mean, he had never said the words.
Right.
So, and that was, you know, she couldn't be, like I said, she couldn't be tokenized in any way. You know, her sexuality had to be an element of her character. It couldn't be the character. You know, and the idea that some mugger is going to be worried that, oh, I'm being beaten up by the gay one. You know? It hurts more because the gay boot. You know? Actually, I think, you know, or that Batman would even care.
Right.
I mean, like, he would give a rat's ass, you know. I mean, but it'd be further from his list of, you know, things I care about. So, you know, I mean, it was a question of, like I said, when the time came to do those issues that ultimately became the Detective Comics run, the onus was on us to deliver a character that the gay community could look at and go, okay, you know, we approve. We do not have a problem with this. But just as importantly, or even arguably more importantly, if you were going to take the mission statement as implied seriously, was that she had to be a character that mainstream male and female readers would look at and be like, she is awesome. And the fact that she's queer is one of the awesome things about her. You know, I mean, we kind of were going to be safe. You know, you mentioned the GLAAD Award at the front, and I'll tell you, no matter, winning the GLAAD Award for that, that's not... I believe I've won twice. I think we won for Half a Life as well. And I'm prouder of the Half a Life one because Half a Life was telling a story that really didn't have anything in its favor. But people were going to be well disposed, certainly in the gay community, people were going to be well disposed towards Kate if we were even remotely competent, I think, you know? Because simply the visibility of the character mattered. It mattered, and mattered quite reasonably. It was important. The fact that we didn't screw it up. we've seen that kind of thing be screwed up horribly.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think in other writers' hands, it has been handled much worse. And with Kate kind of you know, borrow one of your words, I mean, the verisimilitude of someone not only who is out, but who has a very strong military background and has a father who, you know, is not only an important part of her life, but also an important part of her work. Mm-hmm. And has that shared military experience. I mean, each one of those notes to me, along with the, you know, obviously many, you know, our friends and colleagues and our, you know, lesbians, and there's such a variety of lesbians that even to say, well, Lipstick or Butch is kind of like, you know, too.
I mean, that's exactly it. Say, we're gonna label her already. You know, I mean, she's already dealing with enough. I've never thought of her as particularly Butch or femme.
Yeah.
You know, they're in the Renee Kate relationship. If you're gonna label it, Renee's the Butch, but I wouldn't label it.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't. I would be loath to. One of my favorite moments in that story is the moment when Kate comes home from West Point after having been kicked out and has the scene with her dad. You know, where he says, well, what, you got a pass? And she says, no, I've been separated from the Army. You know, and it's under this article. And, you know, and Dad immediately is like, that's homosexual conduct. And her response is, yes, sir.
Hmm.
And, you know, and I love that Jacob's response to his daughter is, well, you didn't lie. You were your own person. And you stayed true to yourself. And you are the daughter I have raised you to be. You did in that moment what any reasonable human being would want of their child. You stood up straight, and you didn't back down, and you didn't hide from what you were, because there's nothing there to hide from, and it's their loss, and I am proud of you.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, that moment, you know, those are the things, those human moments are the things that are going to elevate any story. And if we were successful, I think we were successful because we were honest to Kate's experience. We didn't, you know, in as much as you can be honest to anybody's experience in Gotham City, we didn't, you know, we never cheated, and we didn't make it easy on her. But by the same token, you know, her most heroic moment to me in that story is when she's standing in front of, you know, I forget his name, it's been a while since I read it, and she says, you know, he says, you know what I need to hear, and she says, well, I'm not going to say it. I can't say it. I'm gay. I'm not going to lie. That, to me, is the birth of a hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, never mind what's happened in the 2-3 issues prior. So,
right.
Anyway.
Well, I think that, you know, you were saying, you know, the other award, but I think that the way you handled that whole thing really is what showed why that award was so important. And I agree. I think you're right. A lot of writers would have been given recognition for being attached to something like that, but I mean, you earned it many times over for that handling, and you know, every person.
I certainly appreciate that. I absolutely don't want to make it seem like I don't appreciate it. It is an honor, and it is a huge honor. But I do feel that, like I said, it's you know, you write this story where a character gets to wear the bat and say, hey, I'm gay and I'm right here and I'm not going anywhere and I'm not ashamed of it and it's not a big deal. You know, for the character,
right,
as opposed to for the publisher. And that's the other thing I love about Kay is that she doesn't, you know, she doesn't go through contortions. She knows she's queer fairly early on.
Mm-hmm.
She is fortunate in that, you know. She does not have, she really doesn't experience the trauma of the closet. And that is, you know, again, that's her experience as opposed to, say, a character like Renee, who is not only remarkably closeted, but then is forced out of the closet in a very traumatic fashion.
Yeah.
Like I said, you want to be, you know, these are people, and you have to treat them as people. That's what makes the stories work. If you don't, then all you're doing is moving, you know, cardboard figures about on a playing field and dressing them up occasionally. And, you know, paper dolls are all well and good, but after a while, they get kind of boring.
Yeah, it's funny. Me growing up, it's early on, somebody, one of my counselors was just like, don't let my homosexuality define me. You're not gay, Eric. You're Eric who happens to be gay. Mm-hmm. And that always sat with me. And to see how you handled Batwoman, to see that that's not what she's talking about, how I saw other heroes that happen to be gay, that they're gay first and then they're that hero, and to see you doing the reverse was just fantastic. It was just brilliant.
Well, that's that's the best thing to hear, man, because that's the goal. And that was, and it mattered, like I said, it mattered to Jim and it mattered to me and it mattered to Michael so much to be able to do. And we were also, you know, we were also painfully aware. This is three guys writing this character, you know, in an industry that is not really known for its feminist stance. So, I mean, we knew how badly it could go. But you know, I'll tell you something, and this is, and it's funny. We got the scene in the second arc where Kate and Renee have clearly spent the night, and Renee's getting ready to leave, and there's this wonderful kiss. It's one of the best kisses I've ever seen in comics. That Jim drew, and we went back and forth, and all three of us, we were like, well, they give us any trouble for this. This is the thing we will go to the mat for. We will walk off the book. We will make such a stink if they. There was not a whisper. Nobody said anything. They were like, that's a great thing. You know, which I think tells you everything you need to know about. You know, people look at DC and their behavior, and they're very quick to go, well, that's homophobic, and there is. If there's homophobia at DC, I have never seen it. There's certainly tone deafness, but that's not limited to the portrayal of queer characters. Right. They've gotten everybody with that, you know. but they you know, like I said, we were like, okay, this might be the fight. We were all ready to get into this big tussle over, and there was no fight. I mean, there's just nothing. They were like, yeah, great, do it. That's fantastic. Great work. Keep up. You know.
Nice. Did you get any slack for when you were writing? Did any kind of negative feedback about the character from people, or was it pretty positive?
Not in company. I'm sure there were people out there who hated everything we did and still do, and, you know, feel that I am, a slave to the gay agenda, et cetera, et cetera. They can go fuck themselves.
Yeah, right. You're absolutely adorable.
Well, no, I have no patience for that.
Yeah.
Do I have an agenda? Absolutely, I do. I'm a liberal humanist. I believe that, you know, trying to legislate who... I think the idea of having to even fight for marriage equality is absurd. You know, I think trying to legislate what consenting adults do with regards to how they love each other, it's insane. I mean, that's a bunch of people who don't understand the world and are afraid, trying to, you know, exert some sort of control for reasons that I really have tried to understand and I cannot. So I'm shameless about, you know, whatever my agenda is. You know, I writers have to be political. You have to believe something. Or else there's going to be no merit in the work. I do not believe you tell the story for the sake of the story, absolutely, but you cannot then say, well, the story doesn't have any meaning outside of the story. And there are some people out there who do believe that, and I don't. I am responsible for my words, and I am responsible for the fact that somebody's going to read my words, and they're going to take them to heart one way or another. Not everybody will, but to somebody out there, they're going to read what I've written, and it's going to matter to them. And I need to exert my responsibility over those words. And that means if I'm writing a comic book and I've got a bunch of bad guys and the bad guys are black, I need to be aware of what I am saying, you know?
Right.
Inadvertently or not, I have to be aware of that visual. If I have a character and he's out and he's gay and I kill him in my story, well, all my straight males are still wandering around at the end, I have to be aware that I am saying something, inadvertent or not.
Yeah.
You know, people who know my work, you know, they're going to figure out who's safe and who isn't pretty quickly. You know?
Right.
Because until we have a preponderance of, you know, representation, then representation has to be portrayed responsibly. You know?
Right. So let me ask you about Lazarus, because I feel like with Lazarus, you've kind of taken yourself out of the contemporary issues, and you're using the speculative fiction approach to get to do the speculative fictions approach to commentary. So, you know, Star Trek set in the far future, but telling stories relevant today, all that.
One of the joys of sci-fi.
Exactly. So is that – now, I read the first trade. That's as far as I've gotten. And being a big sci-fi nut, you know, loving not only, you know, far future, you know, crazy, you know, sci-fi stuff, but also the near now and the dystopian or really alternate-topia. I mean, it's not – you know, no perfect world, but certainly not the world we see today, but with trapings of that. Do you is that part of what you're trying to do with Lazarus? Is it a is it meant to be that kind of speculative fiction where you do comment on, you know, the politics and the economics of our society?
If you've read the trade, and that's all there is, mind you, that trade is the first four issues.
Okay.
What you don't get in the trade, however, is the back matter that has been in the floppies.
Yes.
And if you read the back matter of the floppies, it's pretty clear.
Okay.
I mean, this is – Lazarus comes out of, you know, me obsessing over the current economic situation or the economic situation of the last couple of years and going, well, how bad could it get? I mean, what happens if the 99% becomes 99.9999999%? And that point – then that 1% becomes 0.0000, you know, on and on.
Yeah.
When wealth becomes so concentrated that the society ultimately collapses back into a feudal state. Now, having said that, right, nobody wants to be lectured to. God knows I don't. And it goes back to what I was saying about when we were talking about Kate. You know, nobody wanted to write an after-school special because nobody wants to be told, you know, gay people are just like you and me. No, really? Well, there's a news flash. Stop the frickin' pressing, right? What you want is you want a story that engages you and that draws you along, and then maybe if you can do it right, maybe that story will also get you thinking about some things. Maybe that story will get you thinking about where we are conceivably headed if we do not find a way to give the voice of the people back to the people in this democracy instead of having them shouted down and drowned out by money.
Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, we should talk a little bit about the dangers of science running amok, or what it means that Monsanto actually can soil lock certain lands and keep you from being able to grow anything on it unless you use their seed or their fertilizer. These are things that are of issue. You know, I mean, Jesus Christ, take a look at the situation we are in with the environment right now, the climate right now. You know, white people are not weeping and rending their clothes over the IPCC report. I don't understand. Because this report came out less than, a month ago?
Not even.
It's over. Guys, we lost. It's screwed. We have hit the tipping point.
Yep.
There was a story that ran on the BBC about a month and a half ago that said, it was a month and a half ago because it was in August that said that our forests had exhausted their ability to absorb carbon for the year in August, right? In terms of the annual calendar and the atmosphere's ability to be processed, we'd already burnt through it. So all the crap that we're producing now, there's no place for it to go, right? I mean, we're in so much trouble. I mean, It's bad.
It's almost so much that I think to many people who don't have a strong opinion either way, it's surreal to them, and their brains cannot accept the reality of it, so they just think, oh, well, like I've seen in every movie, you know, they'll fix it. They'll come up with something, you know. Hopefully they'll all solve that later, you know.
It's too hard. I don't want to have to pay attention.
Yeah.
I don't really understand it.
Yeah.
It's easier if I just ignore it and leave it to smart people. And, oh, I've been told that smart people aren't cool, by the way. There's a whole freaking political movement in this country right now that is built on, I don't trust you because you're one of them thinking people.
Yep.
How fucked up is that?
Yay, Tea Party. So with Lazarus, though, I really do love it. And the reason I asked if you had that kind of approach to it, because from that first trade, you don't see the, I think the most revealing thing is the head of the Carlisle family has that typical country club sweater tied around his neck. Like, that was the, like, most, you know, not beating you over the head, but certainly the most recognizable image of preppy, rich, country club, et cetera. But I really, it really spoke to me, Neil Blomkamp, you know, obviously District 9 and Elysium, like, you guys are on a very eerily similar wavelength in the portrayal of humanity, and I'm sure we'll see more of the rest or the serfs or, you know, that class of people.
Yeah, no, the second arc actually spends a lot of time with the waste. And there are sort of three narratives moving along in the second arc. And in one of the narratives, you are following a family of rural waste as they are forced to sort of abandon the life that they've managed to eke out for themselves. And they have to, they actually end up having to go to Denver in the hope that they will, in the hope that their kids will be selected by the Carlisle sort of regime to be elevated, to be lifted to serf status. Because if they are lifted, the whole family comes with them. And so, yeah, you see how horrible it is for the have-nots. You know, the first arc is all about the haves.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it introduces forever. And, you know, the ruling family, well, they're the royal family of their domain. They've got it all. You don't spend a whole lot of time with the people who are living quite literally in the mud.
So. Yeah. Well, that's what I loved about Elysium. You gave that ground level, so to speak, you know, that waste level view of humanity and contrasted it with the ruling class up in the space station. But I mean, no, it's great sci-fi, and I was actually thinking it also has an element of the Hunger Games to draw on something else that's immensely popular, in that it shows that class struggle very starkly. So yeah, I'm excited that this is, so you have this mapped out for a fairly long run then, or is this,
Yeah, I know Michael and I have talked about it, and I've been leery, you know, up until fairly recently of talking about, yeah, I've been saying, oh, maybe 75 issues or whatnot. And Michael and I had a talk a little while ago, and he said, no, dude, I mean, we're doing this until we're done. And I was like, excellent. So, you know, I mean, we could do easily 150, 200 issues.
Wow.
But, you know, I mean, that would be quite easy for us to accomplish with it. So we're going to do it for as long as we can, I think, is probably the best way to put it.
Very cool. Now I have to go buy the issues, I guess, to get the back matter.
Well, now let's also ask her about the name.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So this was the only thing I found a little confusing is Lazarus, Carlisle Lazarus. No, wait, no. This is, I mean, Forever Carlisle.
Yeah.
She is a Lazarus.
Yeah.
And they sometimes call her Eve or Eve?
Eve.
Okay.
Eve is the nickname.
Is that like a short from Forever? Or?
Yes.
Okay, that's kind of, it dawned on me as I was reading it actually this evening. I'm like, oh, okay. Because there were just so many names. And then I thought, well, maybe this is like a multiple personality a la Dollhouse where she's, you know.
No, her name's Forever. Her family calls her Eve.
Okay. And I love that, like that, kind of like a Dollhouse, sort of in the sense that you can't trust what your surroundings tell you. She really believes, and this is very compelling to her motivation, that she is a member of the family like everybody else. Yeah. When in fact she has been
well programmed.
Yeah.
Shall we say.
Well, it's really I'm very excited. I mean, Blade Runner, all the great dystopian influences have come before. Seeing that, you know, as like a through line through this is very exciting. So I'm on board now. I was like, I didn't know. I heard good things. Tried it out first volume. I'm hooked. So, and now I gotta buy issues, I guess. Yeah. you're gonna keep doing the great back matter, then I guess I should just do issues.
Well, I mean, we hope one day, ideally, when we get to the hardcover trade editions, we'll be including a lot of the world building material. For instance, there's a timeline that runs in the back matter of the issues, so you can see sort of how the world got to where it is, and things like that.
Very cool. Now, this is a, sort of a production-related thing. Image is now selling the PDFs of their work.
Yes, you can get the digital issues through the Image website, actually. You don't have to go through Comixology.
Okay.
Which, frankly, I'm a big fan of, because as convenient and wonderful as Comixology is, they take a great big chunk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for Michael and me, I think we see a better share if you get your digital copy. And on top of that, it's DRM-free, yes. And you get to keep it forever. It's not in the cloud. You can download it in any format you like, and it's yours. So,
yeah, I'm a big fan of the Brian K. Vaughan, Marcos Martin book, Private Eye.
Yeah.
For similar reason, because, I mean, I use Comixology all the time. Of course, I do love that Comixology has worked through the retailers to give them a cut. And, of course, even the big two, actually a couple other publishers that have the little codes, that's another really enticing way for me to buy these books, but I'm very intrigued what Image is doing, so I may have to check that out. Very cool. I really, Greg, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
It's been great talking to you guys. Even Jared, who didn't say anything.
Oh, he's
I know Jared didn't say anything.
He's an exhausted grad student, so you know he. God bless him. He comes and shows up even on our normal show. Don't be offended, because he won't say much at all.
Yeah,
I am. I'm not offended at all.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You have been amazing. I truly, truly appreciate this, and I hope to see you again.
Flame off!
Thanks for listening to Flame On, a podcast made possible by Powder Milk Biscuits, the ones in the blue box, A Comic Shop, Nerdapalooza, and the generous support of tops and bottoms like you. If you want to be one of our sugar daddies, you can help out by telling a cute single friend about us, reviewing us on iTunes, or putting some dollars down our digital G-string in our monthly support drive. For more ridiculously entertaining and socially enlightening episodes of Flame On, as well as other fine programs, head on over to nerdyshow.com. You can subscribe to Flame On and all Nerdy Show Network podcasts via iTunes. And be sure to find us on Twitter at Flame On Podcast or Facebook on our Flame On fan page. And make sure to check out flameonshow.com for more nerdy queer in your ear.